6:13.
That's right. It features the thoughts and writings of Rabbi Yair Hoffman.
We are your hosts, Asher and Miriam.
So Passover is just around the corner.
It is indeed.
And, you know, one of the big things, the central obligations of the Seder night, is that we have to see ourselves like personally leaving Egypt.
That's right. Vavra vavra bora.
Exactly. So today, we thought we'd go on a bit of an expedition connected to that. We're trying to get a clearer picture, maybe, of the Pharaoh of that Exodus.
Oh, the big antagonist.
Yeah. I mean, he's this figure we all know from the story, right?
Hmm.
And you've probably wondered, I know I have, who exactly was he?
It's a really natural question. I mean, as you're telling the story, engaging with it year after year, this person, this ruler, who stood against God, who enslaved our ancestors. Understanding who he might have been is, well, just adds another layer, doesn't it?
Totally. And it feels like more than just, you know, historical trivia. The Talmud, Pesachim 116b, it says exactly that.
Yeah.
Every generation, each person has to see themselves as if they came out of Egypt. And Rav Dessler in Miktav Meliyahu, he takes it even deeper. He talks about time being cyclical, somehow making that ancient Exodus feel present like it's happening now.
Like a profound concept.
Yeah.
Makes the whole experience much more immediate.
It really does. So when we're sitting there on Passover night and we're supposed to be envisioning the escape, you know, picturing Nachshon Ben Aminadab at the edge of the sea.
Well, water rising.
Pharaoh's chariots bearing down.
Yeah.
The question, who was this Pharaoh, feels, I don't know, more urgent. Like, what was his name? What can history actually tell us about him?
By exploring these different possibilities, we're not just, you know, ticking off boxes in a story. We're connecting to it personally with more maybe informed imagination.
Okay, so let's dive in. Where do we even start looking for this guy?
Well, one fascinating place, maybe a bit unexpected for some, is a text called the Sefer HaYasher.
Ah, the Book of the Upright. I've heard of it. First printed in Venice, right? Way back.
That's the one. Venice, 1525. There's a more recent edition too, Alter Bergman in Tel Aviv.
Okay. But what's the deal with it? Like, who wrote it? When? Is it considered, you know, reliable?
That's the tricky part. The author is anonymous, and there's a real debate about the dating. Some scholars place it way back, maybe the time of the Tanaim, the early sages.
Wow, that early.
Potentially. Others argue it's a later compilation, maybe medieval. And that, of course, impacts how you weigh its historical claims.
Right, because Tanaitic era would give it a lot more weight, historically speaking.
Precisely. Dating and authorship are always crucial with historical sources. But regardless of the exact timing, Sefer HaYashar offers some really unique details, things you don't find in, say, the mainstream Midrashim.
Okay, intriguing. So what does it say about this pharaoh? Spill the beans.
All right, so according to Sefer HaYashar, this pharaoh, he takes the throne pretty young, 20 years old.
20? That is young for a pharaoh.
Yeah. Apparently his father, named Melol, had this incredibly long reign, 94 years, but was sick for the last 10. And here's where it gets really specific. Sefer HaYashar gives the pharaoh's name as Adikam Ahuz.
Adikam Ahuz. Okay, does Ahuz mean anything?
It does. We're told it means short in Egyptian.
Short, like literally short.
Literally short. The text actually describes him as being only an amma and a half tall. Let's see, that's roughly 2 1/4 feet.
Wait, 2 1/4 feet tall? Seriously?
That's what it says. And it gets better. It says he was, and I quote, exceedingly ugly with a beard that grew all the way down to his feet.
No way. That's wild. It's like picturing one of Snow White's dwarfs, but, you know, the pharaoh's crown.
It's definitely a striking image, isn't it? Very different from the powerful, imposing figure we usually imagine. It kind of throws a wrench into that typical archetype.
It really does. It makes you wonder how someone described, like, commanded an empire.
Absolutely. The text also gives a time frame. It says his reign started the 206th year of Israel's descent into Egypt.
Okay.
And it only lasted 4 years.
Just 4 years. That's short, too, compared to his father.
Very short. And interestingly, it mentions that Ahuz, the short part, was mostly a pejorative, mm-hmm. like a nickname used by his advisors, maybe behind his back.
Ah, palace intrigue.
Seems like it. His subjects, the general populace, apparently just called him Adikam.
Hmm. So this raises the question again, how reliable is this Sefer HaYashar? Should we take this description, you know, literally?
It's a fair question. We have to be critical. But as you alluded to, it's not just random tales. It has other interesting details, like about Zipporah's stature, Moses' wife, that aren't elsewhere.
Right.
And, you know, respected figures like Rabbi Arya Kaplan actually used material from Sefer HaYashar in his commentary on the Chumash. Plus, you find parallels to some of its ideas in other midrashim, even in the Gemara sometimes.
So it's not totally out there. It has some standing within the tradition.
Exactly. So maybe not accepting every single detail as like modern historical fact, but definitely seeing it as a valuable source, a unique lens within our tradition for understanding the Exodus.
Okay, that makes sense. A traditional source, maybe not mainstream, but with its own interesting perspective. So let's switch gears then. What about secular history? What do mainstream historians say? They've identified tons of pharaohs, right?
Oh, definitely. Secular history, using archaeology, Egyptian records, other ancient texts, offers a completely different angle.
Yeah.
Now, a key point for us here is we can potentially look at the names and the general context they provide without necessarily having to buy into their entire chronological timeline, which, as you know, often differs quite a bit from traditional Jewish dating.
Right. The timelines can be tricky to sync up. So, okay, if we use the traditional dating for the Exodus, roughly 2444 in the Hebrew calendar, when the Torah says the old pharaoh died and a new one arose.
Exodus 2.23. Yeah.
Right. Where does that land, roughly, on the secular BCE timeline?
Okay, so based on standard secular chronologies,
yeah,
that period, the death of one pharaoh, rise of the next, leading up to the Exodus, would fall somewhere around 1316 BCE.
1316 BCE. So according to secular historians, who was the pharaoh ruling around then?
The main figure identified for that specific time frame is usually Horemheb. He was the last pharaoh of the 18th dynasty.
Horemheb. Okay. Now, what about Ramses II? You hear his name thrown around a lot, especially because of the city of Ramses mentioned in Exodus.
Right. Exodus 1.11. That's the big connection people make. And it's tempting. But the problem is, most secular historians date Ramses II much later. His reign is usually placed around, say, 1279 to 1113 BCE, maybe starting a bit earlier, but definitely peaking later.
So like over a century after that 1316 BCE mark?
Exactly. It creates a chronological gap if you're trying to align it directly with the traditional Exodus date.
Mm-hmm.
Now, dating ancient history is complex. There are debates, revisions.
Mm-hmm.
But based on current consensus, Ramses II is a bit late.
Hmm. Okay. So Horemheb is closer, chronologically speaking, but Ramses has the city name connection. Are there any other major contenders from the secular side?
Well, another possibility comes up if you allow for a potential discrepancy in the dating systems. Some scholars, including Rabbi Kaplan, again, have explored this. If you adjust for a difference of maybe 160-something years.
A dating shift, basically.
Yeah, a potential systematic difference between the chronologies. If you factor that in, then Thutmose III becomes a strong candidate. His reign is dated roughly 1479 to 1425 BCE by secular historians.
Okay, so Thutmose III, that's earlier than Horemheb, but potentially aligns better if you accept a chronological adjustment.
Correct. He was a very powerful pharaoh of the 18th dynasty, known for military campaigns. So another plausible figure, depending on how you reconcile the timelines.
Interesting. So we have Adikam Ahuz from Sefer Hayashar, and then Horemheb, Ramses II, Thutmose III from secular history. Quite a few possibilities. But you mentioned another track earlier involving an Egyptian priest.
Ah, yes, Manetho. This is a really fascinating thread. Manetho was an Egyptian priest, lived in Heliopolis during the Ptolemaic era under Greek rule.
Okay, so after the main pharaonic period.
Right, 3rd century BCE. He was commissioned by Ptolemy I to write a history of Egypt in Greek called Egyptica.
Egyptica. Is that text still around?
Unfortunately, the original is lost. But pieces of it, summaries and quotes, were preserved by later writers, most importantly, the Jewish historian Josephus.
Okay, so we have fragments via Josephus. What does Manetho say that's relevant?
Manetho mentions a pharaoh named Cheops II, or Pepi II. He was from the 6th dynasty, which is much earlier than the new kingdom pharaohs like Horemheb or Thutmose. We're talking Old Kingdom Egypt.
Way earlier, okay. What's special about Pepi II?
According to Manetho's account, Pepi II had an extraordinarily long reign. He supposedly ruled from the age of 6 until he was 100 years old.
A 94-year reign. That's incredible. Almost a century on the throne.
It's one of the longest reigns claimed for any monarch in history.
Wow. Now, you mentioned historians, they're sometimes skeptical about Manetho dates.
They are, yeah. There's always the possibility, especially when writing under foreign rule, like the Ptolemies, that Manetho might have, let's say, embellished the lengths of reigns or the glory of past dynasties for political or cultural reasons, to emphasize Egypt's ancient grandeur.
Makes sense. Standard practice for ancient historians sometimes.
But what's really interesting is that Manetho's claim about this long-reigning Pepi II gets some backup from Egyptian sources themselves. Specifically, the Turin Royal Canon.
What's that?
It's a papyrus list of kings written in hieratic script dating from the time of Ramses II, ironically enough. It lists rulers going way back, including names that seem to line up with Manetho's six dynasty kings, and it does seem to support a very long reign for Pepi II.
So Egyptian evidence potentially corroborates Manetho's name about this super long reigning old kingdom pharaoh, Pepi II.
Exactly. It lends credibility to the idea that such a ruler existed and reigned for an exceptionally long time.
Okay, so we have this Pepi II ruling way back for ages. How does that connect to the Exodus? That seems like a huge chronological leap backwards.
It does seem like a leap, but the connection comes through another remarkable piece of evidence, the Ipuwer Papyrus.
The Ipuwer Papyrus. I think I've heard of that. What is it exactly?
It's an ancient Egyptian poem, basically. It's preserved on a papyrus, currently housed in the National Archaeological Museum in Leiden in the Netherlands.
A poem, so not necessarily a historical chronicle.
Well, that's the debate. Scholars argue whether Ipuwer's descriptions are meant to be a literal account of disasters that happened, or if it's more, you know, literary, metaphorical, describing a time of chaos using poetic language. Maybe a bit of both.
Okay. But what does the poem describe?
It describes Egypt in absolute turmoil, total societal collapse, natural disaster, suffering. And the parallels between its descriptions and the biblical account of the 10 plagues are, frankly, stunning.
Really? Like what? Give me some examples.
Okay, get this. The papyrus says, plague is throughout the land, blood is everywhere, and lo, the river is blood.
Wow. That's pretty direct, like the first plague.
Exactly. Then it says, men shrink from tasting, human beings thirst after water, which sounds an awful lot like Exodus saying the Egyptians couldn't drink the Nile water.
Yeah, that's uncanny. What else?
It talks about fire. Forsooth, gates, columns, and walls are consumed by fire. Maybe not a direct match to a single plague description in Exodus, but it suggests widespread fiery destruction.
General chaos and destruction.
Right. An economic collapse, Lower Egypt weeps, the entire palace is without its revenues. Sounds like the plague's hitting the economy hard. Mm-hmm. It also mentions grain has perished on every side, which lines up with plagues like hail or locust destroying crops.
Okay, those are strong parallels.
In the sense of speed, of sudden devastation, one line says, forsooth, that has perished which was yesterday seen. Things are just vanishing overnight.
That feels like the pace of the plagues, one after another.
It does. And then there's the human suffering. The papyrus has really disturbing lines like, forsooth, the children of princes are dashed against the walls or cast out in the streets.
Oof, that's grim. Reminds you of the last plague, maybe.
It certainly evokes immense tragedy and societal breakdown. It also says, he who places his brother in the ground is everywhere, and it is groaning throughout the land, mingled with lamentations, widespread death and mourning.
Just like the cry throughout Egypt after the death of the firstborn?
Precisely. And maybe one of the most striking parallels, thinking about the aftermath of the Exodus, Ipuwer complains that gold and lapis lazuli, silver and malachite are fastened on the neck of female slaves.
Wait. Slaves suddenly wearing precious materials.
Yeah, it sounds like a massive transfer of wealth, a complete reversal of the social order, which fits perfectly with the Israelites leaving Egypt laden with gold and silver given by the Egyptians.
That is really remarkable. The similarities are hard to ignore.
They really are. And you even mentioned an interesting point about the Sephorno's commentary.
Oh, yeah. The Sephorno, commenting on the plague of Sephardorea, usually translated as frogs, he suggests it might actually mean crocodiles. Which makes sense, you know, Nile crocodiles. And interestingly, the Ipuwer Papyrus also mentions crocodiles behaving abnormally, being destructive, coming out of the river.
Another potential link.
Yeah.
It's fascinating how these different sources, the biblical text, later commentary, and this ancient Egyptian poem, might converge.
So, putting it all together, the Sefer HaYashar's short, ugly Atikama Hus, the secular candidates like Horemheb or Thutmose III or maybe even Ramses II, and then this Pepi II connection via Manetho and the Ipuwer Papyrus, describing events just like the plagues, it's a lot to take in.
It is. It's a complex puzzle with pieces from very different boxes.
But it all circles back, doesn't it, to what we started with, that obligation on Passover. In every generation, a person must see themselves.
Exactly, as if they personally left Egypt. This isn't just an intellectual exercise trying to pin down a historical figure. The Rambam is very clear on this.
Right, in Hilkos Chometsu Matzah.
Chapter 7, Halacha 6. He derives it straight from the verse in Deuteronomy, and you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt. The Rambam says it means we have to literally see ourselves as if we were slaves and as if we were personally redeemed and freed.
And the very next law, Halakha 7, connects directly to that feeling, right, with a physical action.
Precisely. The next halacha says that because of this obligation to see ourselves as freed, when we eat the matzah and drink the four cups at the seder, we must do it while leaning.
Like free people relaxing at a banquet.
Exactly. Leaning becomes the physical embodiment, the enactment of that internal vision. We're not just thinking about freedom, we're physically performing it, reminding ourselves that this story is our story.
Wow. So the leaning isn't just some old custom, it's tied directly to that core obligation of personally experiencing the exodus in our imagination.
That's the Rambam's understanding. It makes the whole Seder feel much more active, more immersive.
It really does. So, okay, as we get ready for Pesach this year, maybe this exploration gives us something new to bring to that visualization.
I think so.
Whether you choose to picture maybe that surprisingly short bearded Pharaoh Adikam Ahu's chasing you in his chariot, borrowing from Sefer HaYashar.
Or maybe you connect the plagues you're recounting to those vivid, haunting descriptions from the Ipur Papyrus, imagining that level of nationwide chaos.
Right. Or maybe just knowing that historians debate figures like Thutmose or Horemheb adds a layer of historical depth. Whatever image resonates, the goal is the same, isn't it?
Absolutely. The goal is to make that jump, to feel the chains, and then to feel the liberation personally.
So we've covered a lot today, some really fascinating stuff, even if it's sometimes contradictory, about who this pharaoh might have been, what he might have looked like.
Definitely a deep dive into some varied sources.
But I guess the main takeaway, really, is that no matter who the specific historical person was, whether it was Adikam or Pepi or someone else, that fundamental obligation to connect personally with the Exodus, that's what truly matters on Seder night.
Couldn't agree more. That remains the unchanging heart of the experience.
Still, thinking about this deeper dive into the context, the possibilities, it does make you wonder, doesn't it? How does thinking about, say, the Ipur Papyrus change how you feel when you talk about the plague of blood?
That's a great question to ponder. And it opens up other avenues too. What other details in the Exodus story might have surprising historical echoes or textual layers we haven't even considered? Maybe something for everyone to think about as they prepare for their own Seder this year.